five bills on the agenda. We will be deleting the second one, Senate File 2773. Senator Pappas has asked for that to be rescheduled. To accommodate some of the testifiers from Greater Minnesota, we will first go to Senate File 3157, Senator Saltzman, the library media specialist legislation. That'll be followed by Senate File 3156 on effective literacy instruction. Then we'll go to Senator Rummel's Senate File 2882 on school report card. And finally, we hope to at least start discussion on the Department of Education's policy and technical bill. Senator Saltzman.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it feels like it is truly Literacy Day here in the Senate Education Committee because we'll be talking about it several times today. But Senate File 3157 is a bill that requires every school to have a licensed library media specialist in their building. Studies show consistently that student achievement is higher in schools with a licensed media specialist, and an increasing number of our schools are staffing their schools with either paraprofessionals or else volunteers because they have cut the licensed media specialist in their libraries. You know, the librarians that perhaps we knew as students is very different today because they are also dealing with information and technology literacy skills. They are guiding students in really selecting appropriate reading and research materials, promoting reading, and much more. There are currently 21 states, including Wisconsin and Iowa, that require schools to have licensed media specialists. I know that we have had tremendous cuts across Minnesota. We heard those stories today in our E-12 Finance Committee. And so I think that this is an important time for us to realize what is being cut from our schools, what kind of programs, what kind of staff support, and really what our children are really losing out on when we have to cut in this very important area. So with me today is Doug Johnson. He is with the Mankato Area Public Schools, and Linda Wise, who is a St. Paul school librarian at Como Park High School in their media department. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Mr. Johnson and Ms. Wise.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Doug Johnson. I'm the Director of Media and Technology for the Mankato Area Public Schools, and I also serve as the Legislative Chair for the MEMO, Minnesota Educational Media Organization here in Minnesota. We're a group of about 600-plus school library media specialists and technology integration specialists. So with that, this is a bill that's got our association very excited. Just real quickly, would all the people here in support of this bill stand? Just real quickly. We're very excited, very pleased.
And we recognize it's your day at the Capitol, and
yeah,
welcome.
Yeah. You know what? We'd have been here even if it wasn't our day at the Capitol, I think. Thank you for considering this bill. I'm going to be very, very brief here and just simply say this. It's time that Minnesota starts to recognize that good school library services led by a professional school librarian are a core service that schools should provide all students in the state of Minnesota. Over the last few years, we've seen over 375 of our public schools cut or replace school library media specialists and replace them with paraprofessionals, replace them with parent volunteers, or not replace them at all. And as a result, we've got a lot of kids in the state not getting the kind of services that they need. Our school librarians today, our school library media specialists today, teach information literacy skills. And information literacy skills we know are critical in information literacy, information economy. They're teaching good technology skills, not just how to use the technology, but how to behave and how to remain safe on the internet as well. And finally, they also are instrumental in creating kids who not only can read, but kids who want to read and will continue to read throughout their lives. We think that all of those are absolutely core and absolutely critical for a well-educated person in the 21st century. You're going to have some other people talk to you about the research, so I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to turn this over, the testimony over, to people who have volunteered to tell some of their stories about what's been happening in their district, some media specialists, some parents, and some students. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Wise.
Thank you.
Welcome.
First of all, I'd like to say thank you to Senator Saltzman for writing this bill, and to you, Senator Wieger, for co-authoring it, and Senator Scheid as well. And thank you for giving us this opportunity to share with you some of our stories. I'm a high school public school librarian in St. Paul. And up to this point, it may have been kind of a surprise for you to find out that there aren't licensed people in libraries all over the place anymore. And more important, the question on the table might be, who cares? What difference does it make? Well, first of all, if we look at the elementary school level, students who are in schools without licensed library media specialists miss out on a great deal, because these professionals are at the core teachers. They aren't just book managers. They collaborate with other teachers to support curriculum. They make sure that there's every reading level available in the library. They teach kids how to use the library, how to find books appropriate to their reading level. They teach kids how to make books and even how to get excited about books. Also, the other piece is the technology. Now kids have to learn how to navigate the internet, and our elementary librarians are doing this as well. They tutor struggling students and provide a welcoming environment in which to do this. Now, volunteers and teaching assistants and paraprofessionals can check books in and check books out, but they are not qualified to teach these kids. It's an equity issue. Some kids get the services of a licensed library media specialist, and others don't. We want to remedy this, especially when we consider it's a particular travesty when some of our neediest students go from elementary school to secondary school and compete in an arena where they don't have the skills that other kids do. We need to change that. And how about the secondary level? Well, I can attest firsthand to what happens there, especially now since we're losing librarians on the middle school and junior high level as well. We see kids arriving in ninth grade who don't know how to find a book in the library. Their idea of doing a research paper or a project or an essay is to walk up to the computer, go on Google, maybe go to Wikipedia, copy and paste, and turn it in. They either aren't aware of or don't care about the consequences of plagiarism. We have to bring these students up to speed with other students who do receive the services of professional library media specialists. We team with staff members in order to turn our kids out into the work world and to college with very good research skills. The norm used to be that they left high school with research know-how, and that when they went to college, they were ready. Well, now more and more we're hearing from our colleges that they have to put these kids through remedial classes in order to have them learn research skills and instill the ethical considerations that they used to get in their K-12 experience. And this results directly from the lack of professionally staffed libraries. So in conclusion, why pass this bill? Well, first of all, as Doug alluded to and Senator Saltzman, the data is there. Over 18 studies have been done nationally, and every one of them shows that there is, on average, a 10 to 20% increase in student achievement in buildings where there's a licensed library media specialist in the library. Would any of us ever think of replacing an English teacher, a social studies teacher, a math teacher with a teaching assistant or a volunteer? Well, what would happen in a classroom if that were to happen happens now in libraries. Second, when some students receive services that others don't, this is an equity issue. And it's unfair to Minnesota families. In the St. Paul public school system alone, 13 years ago, 100% of our schools had licensed librarians. Today, 72% of the secondary schools and only 30% of the elementary schools do. How will our students meet the Minnesota information literacy standards if this is not remedied? And third, not having a licensed librarian in the library can turn into a very expensive prospect. If we consider the scenario of what happens, and incidentally, you do have in your packet a list of highlights. It's called From Minnesota Library and Media Centers. These are just little clips from all over the state, librarians telling their stories of what happens when a school loses their library media specialist. Well, what happens is the staff still needs the books, so they take them. And eventually the library disintegrates. Well, I just looked it up yesterday. The average cost in 2006 of an elementary school library book was $21.60 times 20,000, which is a typical amount of items and materials in an elementary school library. We're talking to reestablish a dismantled library is between $250,000 and $500,000. And finally, I would say most importantly, our students will not be equipped with the research skills they need for the work world or for college. They will not be able to navigate and filter the internet to find reliable sources, and they will walk away from school without the ethical core they need to not only be discerning users of information but responsible users of information. These are crucial 21st century skills that our Minnesota students deserve and need. Please pass this bill and help our students become 21st century learners. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss.
Thank you. There are some students here from Humboldt High School, and I wonder if they could come up, or perhaps just one of them could give some comments for the group. Are they in?
I think
room?
Leslie Yoder is going to introduce her students.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay. Welcome, students, and for those of you speaking, please state your name for the record.
I'm Rebecca Schilling. I'm a sophomore in Humboldt High School.
My name is Carlos Luna, and I'm a senior.
My name is John Reardon, and I'm a sophomore at Humboldt.
I'm Deion Griffin, and I'm also a sophomore at Humboldt.
Okay. Welcome.
As we said, we are students at Humboldt High School in St. Paul, and we are here to tell you why school librarians are important to Minnesota students. First of all, there should be no inequity in education in any area. If something can be done, it should be done. All studies show evidence of the positive impact of school libraries, and we can't ignore the facts. Samuel Johnson said, "The next best thing to knowing something is knowing where to find it."
That's right.
I feel research skills are extremely important to education and should be conveyed to students at the elementary and junior high levels. But due to a lack of librarians, it is difficult for students to learn this. Librarians have a wealth of knowledge on a range of subjects and have knowledge relating to many online research databases like Elm and EBSCRO that even many teachers are unaware of. In my personal experience, librarians have proven invaluable to me, knowing exactly where to find books, resources, and information needed. Without this, I would have been clueless on various research projects and where to find accurate information.
Thank you.
Education should be equal everywhere. But 21 states have passed a similar law, meaning that not even half the states officially have the advantage of receiving the information passed on by media specialists. For an English poetry project we recently did, our librarian had all the materials prepared and ready for the students and the teachers. Without the librarian's resources, things would have been a lot more difficult to find and probably less accurate.
When you have better researching skills, that leads to having better materials. And with better materials, you have a better chance of succeeding. Also, once you go to college, you need to be independent. And to do so, you need to be able to find out how to research on your own and find things on your own in the library. If you don't have any previous experience, it's going to be really hard for you once you get there. And also, less librarians result in lack of awareness with teachers, and many classes don't use the library very often, and the teachers don't really know how to teach research on their own. So.
Well, thank you, students, for your testimonials.
Thank you.
And members, usually we don't have a applause meter, but we'll have an exception today. Well done.
A little trivia, Carlos, would you tell have a marked distinction here in the state. Would you share that?
Yes, my name is Carlos Luna, and I serve on the district council, the West Side Citizens Organization. I'm elected board member on the West Side.
You're the youngest elected
board member? Youngest board member right now. So
congratulations, Carlos. Okay. Okay, Senator Saltzman.
I believe there are three other people who are signed up to testify, but I know that we have a number of bills today, so if they want to just make a very, very brief comment, I think we've covered of the compelling arguments on this bill.
Thank you. And we do have a parent and we have a student. I want to make sure they have a chance to since they came all the way down from Tower Sudan School District.
Absolutely.
As well. Jill, are you here?
Yes.
Come on, introduce your folks, your entourage. Yes.
My name is Jill Heidla, and I'm a library media specialist in Minnesota. I've worked for about 10 years up north. The last 2 years, I am temporarily working in the metro area because a lot of library jobs have been cut up north. I'm going to let these two gals give their comments, and then I'll briefly cover what I have that hasn't already been said yet. This is Barb Broughton, and she is an 11th grader in Tower Sudan, and her mother, Joan.
Okay, well, I'm Barb, and I'm a junior at Tower Sudan High School, and I'm here to support having a...
What year?
A junior.
Okay.
Yep. I'm here to support having a certified librarian media specialist within my school. We used to have one for 5 years, and this position was reduced. When we had this librarian here at our school, we had many programs, and one of them was I Love to Read Month, which helps students learn how to read, and Accelerated Reader, which allowed students to learn how to read and how to understand what they read. And
I'm going to just step in. It's a K through 12 school with about 300 students, K through 12.
Yes, and now that we don't have a librarian, our library is normally closed throughout the day, and I have college courses in my school, which I'm taking, and it's hard for me to get resources because no one's there to help me look for what I need to have, and what I have to say.
Being a parent of a student in this school and seeing that there's no certified librarian, it's really discouraging to not have that professionalism, not have somebody there that's very knowledgeable on the different media types. We would really appreciate your help and gaining this access for our students. And we're in a small town. We don't have a public library. Our high school library is our only library. And this bill would really help promote good education. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you also from me. I guess a couple of the points I wanted to make, and in working in elementary and in K-12 libraries, I've noticed that the neediest students, the ones who really need library support for learning to read and having good materials to read, those are the types of kids who don't have support at home. They don't have parents or grandparents that can bring them to a public library, if there even is one in their town. And those are the kids who don't have parents involved in booster clubs like there are for extracurricular activities that are being cut. So if the school board is announcing a librarian cut, there's not going to be parents to show up to support these kids who are very needy. Some of them move around a lot in the metro area. I have quite a few students who are learning English as their second language. Those are the types of kids who just aren't going to have a lot of parental support. Just one of the schools I worked with up north, an elementary school, they only had 48 state books in their set of state books because Alaska and Hawaii weren't states yet when it was published. That particular library also had 6 books about Cambodia that were published before World War II. And when I brought up trying to support libraries through a state law. A legislator told me that that's a local decision. Superintendents and school boards need to make that decision. But that superintendent in that district felt, we don't need books. You've got plenty in that library. There hadn't been any professional library support in that district for a long time, and it really showed. Another superintendent up north, and not that I'm bashing superintendents, they do have a tough balancing act with declining enrollments and rising transportation costs. But one of our friends up north has been heard saying quite a few times, we don't need libraries now that we have the internet. But you do need somebody trained and skilled and experienced in navigating that internet, that vast amount of information, on effective searching, using databases that have authentic information, and being wise users and evaluators of information. Two brief extra items here. When babies in this state are sent home from the hospital, there is a law they have to be in a car seat. It's for their safety. I don't see any difference between that and requiring a properly staffed and stocked libraries for those babies when they get to be 4 or 5 or 6 and enter school. They do need that support. And I'm just going to close with my personal perfect world essentials. All schools have full-time librarians. All library budgets are adequate. And all students read above or at grade level. And that's the end. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to make a statement on Senate File 3157? Yes, please approach. We can take a couple of more statements, and I think we have
Lisa
ready to vote
Finsness
for
from the Osseo District, who would like to have just 1 minute to summarize a couple of things.
Okay, welcome.
Hello, Senator Weiger. Senator Michelle, I'm a constituent in your district. Senator Saltzman, I know you visited our district, and I'm going to start off by saying I'm the Director of Instructional Media and Technology for the Osseo Area School District, also represent MEMO, and also on the State Library Advisory Board. And one of the things we learned when we were at the RTI response to intervention is that our first K through 3 years, students learn to read. And from then on, it's reading to learn. And I look at I'm going to just mention 4 quick points. One is that I view the school library media specialist, a highly trained, qualified library media specialist, as part of the three-legged school part of the three-legged stool in our child's instructional process and in our academic system, because they have librarianship, everything that students need to know about digital age literacy, they're competent to help provide the classroom teacher in, filling the blocks where the teacher may not know. Secondly, they have technology expertise. They should, if they're a highly qualified librarian in our school system. They fill the gaps and help students and teachers utilize the value our purchases, because the bottom line is we want to get a good investment out of our dollar, and we want students to learn and be successful in the 21st century. The last thing is that they provide the leadership within a school to know how to provide staff development, which I'm not sure was mentioned, but to know how, so that teachers and staff know how to use technology, how to find the resources, all of the wonderful Minitex databases that the state provides. We want to get a good value out of our resources. And live media specialists are licensed teachers. When they're in a classroom, they cut the class size down in half. You're getting a very good value to run and manage a library. So I just want to thank you for considering this. What your support does is give school districts what they really want to do, but they have a difficult time demonstrating that they need to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we have one remaining witness. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, honorable legislators. Thank you very much for giving me this 1 minute. I have let everybody else present the facts. I'm going to present to you the passion. I'm wearing my Teddy Roosevelt T-shirt today.
Oh, and
I'm a Teddy Roosevelt, Patricia Arnold, Roosevelt High School, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Thank you.
Educator 32 years, just celebrated 18 years of being a media specialist. I am here today representing my 1,100-plus students at Roosevelt who could not take the day off to be here. I'm also presenting the one thing about public schools that are different than private schools is the fact that we take any student, any child, into our schools. And I'm very proud to say that in our Roosevelt Teddy Media Center, we have our students from the labels we give them I don't like, life skills, DCD, special ed, ELL students. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is on Fridays to have students come in and do their reading so they become better able readers. When you get to the high school level, ladies and gentlemen, you are talking about students who are at pre-kindergarten to college level reading, and that is a very wide age. I would like to tell you that my students would not be very happy if you were to take me or anybody else away from the media centers, which is what's happening. So thank you today. Please pass the state law. We are as important as anybody else. Thank you. And this is for the kids. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Senator Hatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman. Currently, one of your testifiers said some in St. Paul that 70% of the schools have a media specialist, and I can't remember exactly what the... So, Senator Saltzman, across the state, what is the number of districts or schools that do not have a licensed media specialist right now?
I'd like to ask if you could answer that for me.
Mr. Johnson, an estimate on that question?
In terms of estimate, that's kind of a moving figure. We don't really have very good data on that as far as I know. I know Suzanne Miller is here from the Department of Ed. Can you give an estimate on that? It's your department who collects that sort of we do know that these numbers have been dropping fairly dramatically. Didn't mean to put you on the spot there. But you're one of our better guessers, I would guess.
Well, Senator Weigert, my name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a state librarian at the Minnesota Department of Education. Unfortunately, we do not have a hard number on this. We are in the process of just beginning to do a collection, which we'll be doing this spring for the first time, to identify exactly how many school media centers there are in the state of Minnesota, which will give us a good hard count. But this has not been done in the past, and this is one of our new programs that we're trying to institute.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hatt.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Thank you. The testimony suggested that in past years there were more licensed media specialists than there are today. And so I guess the assumption is that over time school districts, as they've wrestled with their staffing and priorities, have, for whatever reason, variety of reasons perhaps, they've chosen to do this in other ways. If we pass the law and require this to happen, if the school districts have not funded these positions because of budgetary constraints, how will they do this if we pass the law saying they must do it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, absolutely this is an unfunded mandate. But I think that having this bill come forward also illustrates what our children are losing out on when these positions are being cut. Because it's not just a matter of raising class size. They are losing out on access to a program, to a library perhaps, to some of these issues, and that's why I think this bill is so important, is that to raise the issue of the kind of programs that are being cut in our school. And local control is very, very important, but at the same time, sometimes we're not giving school districts a lot of choices. I've also heard that when school districts cut, they look at those things that are not required. And so perhaps they are budgeting for things that they would prefer not to have, but we've mandated that they do, and at the cost of something that is very valuable. So it is a good debate to have, and I appreciate the questions because they are valid.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Saltzman, I appreciate that, and I know that we have talked often in this committee and other committees about the virtues of unfunded mandates and the virtues of local control, and I came off of a school board in Eden Prairie for 8 years, and I know Chairman Weger has and others have too, not in Eden Prairie, but other school districts. And I do understand, I do think that school district school boards are very interested in trying to develop programs and fund things that work. And I think that in the case of a media specialist, as they wrestle with their budgetary constraints and their other constraints, they're trying to make best decisions that are going to be in the best interest of their students. I'm not comfortable with saying that we ought to put this out there, particularly when there is likely to be some cost that we don't know, at least going to local schools, And since we don't know the forecast yet tomorrow, but I suspect we're not going to have a lot of extra money, I'm reluctant to do this and put another mandate out there that would be another constraint for local schools to deal with. I think your point is well taken. It would, to me, would be an argument to have fewer of these rather than more of them. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm not sure that this is the best thing to be doing at this point.
Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman. Senator Saltzman, I commend you on your illustration. It's been very powerful, and you are right that this is an issue that needs to be brought to the forefront. I have some concerns and perhaps some suggestions as well. And one, in terms of a suggestion, the way your language is written, line 1.8, you are saying a media specialist for each school building in the district. And I might just suggest that there are some school districts who have buildings that are more or solely administrative or maintenance-oriented and along those lines. And so as your bill may or may not progress, that would be something that I might suggest that you take a further look at. And I'm guessing that you would think that that would be an appropriate suggestion.
Chair Saltzman?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I'm very, very open to having this discussion because I hope today that, again, we have raised the awareness of what we are losing, because for many of us, we were in schools where the librarian was there. We took it for granted, and I think that many times the public is not aware of what has been cut from our schools. And it's not just that we're cutting a person, we are cutting an entire program and dismantling libraries across the state. So I'm very, very open to any suggestions of how to move this forward.
Sarah Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman. Conversely, I'm very concerned about the fiscal impact of this on our districts and perhaps more than anything, I'm concerned because I know what the budget realities are or have I think we all have a pretty good sense of what tomorrow is going to bring in reality for all of us. And like Senator Hand and Senator Wieger, others at this table, Senator Olsen, Senator Erickson Ropes, many of us come from a school board perspective on this issue. And if I could give some encouragement to the many, many people that are assembled here today, perhaps the larger discussion that needs to take place is one about adequately funding public education in the state of Minnesota and what are our priorities and what are our expectations. Mr. Chair, it is not until the people in Minnesota rise up, and it's through work with organizations like Parents United and others. It is when the people rise up that this will be elevated to take care of not only libraries, but a whole host of other bills that are sitting out there. And I would, my last suggestion, and frankly question, is I'd be interested to know, Senator Saltzman, if the Minnesota School Board Association was consulted on this and if they have a position on this as well.
Senator Saltzman.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, I have chatted with the School Board Association. I don't know if they're going to come testify today, but of course they are concerned about this and the impact on public school budgets because it is an issue of, again, a person, and here comes the School Board Association. Yes. And we work on many things. And again, I want to go back to what you said, Senator Lynch, and that is that raising awareness. And that's what I think this bill, that this discussion is very important to continue to look at. How do, you know, media specialists and also librarians fit into our vision for what children should have access to in their education? And I welcome the School Board Association to the table with me.
Yes. Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Senator Saltzman. My name is Kirk Steino. I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. I have had conversation with Senator Saltzman about this issue, and Senator Lynch, I think you nailed the issue perfectly. It's an economic issue for many school districts, and we believe that this current process, I think it really does kind of create a protected class of employees, and when we go through the process of reductions, we basically take that name off the list based on the evidence in this bill. So this does raise some issues for us, and we find the same issues year after year with school counselors and social workers, and you've seen that over the years. And so we certainly have some concerns about this. We certainly value that what media specialists bring to schools, because they are wonderful people. They bridge the gap between the classroom and learning, and it's something that we don't like to do, but it's a reality for us.
Okay. Further discussion. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Salzman, I have to echo what Senator Lynch is saying and some of the other concerns around the table. I'm another school board member, former school board member, and when I was first elected to the Winona School Board, I really, really wanted to put front-end load money into early childhood. You know, we've talked about the benefits of doing early childhood investments and how that pays off for the rest of the system. I also wanted to install education or language into elementary schools, because all the research shows, you know, if you can get them before, what, age 8 or 9, they're so much better than spending the same amount of money or more in the high school courses. And because of budget problems and being painted into corners, I saw Winona lose its media specialist. And, you know, we tried to come up with such different plans to still keep media specialists in the buildings. And I think, well, this is quite a number of years ago, but if I'm remembering correctly, we had media specialists traveling from building to building, because we're trying to keep neighborhood schools open, because there's a lot of pressure to close neighborhood schools and consolidate to bigger stuff. And, you know, we wound up splitting staff time between buildings and trying to make it work. And I'm just worried that some of the language here, like where you're saying at least one licensed media specialist in each building, not only that you might include some administrative buildings, but the way some school districts are doing it now, with they may have shared multi-grade classrooms, or just the way school districts are different, it may be working okay for them now, and then this would require them to do an extra expenditure in the budget. That means something else has to be cut, and I know you know that. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I have to agree with the School Board Association on this, that, you know, I love media specialists. I grew up in the library from being a little child. I talked to some of the advocates earlier today. I still am in a book club today. I'm an avid reader. But I'm really worried about how this is going to play out on the local level. And there's so many things that are worth funding. You know, should we at the state maybe make a priority list and tell everybody this is the size classroom you have to have, and this is the nutrition program you have to have, and list all those good things, or let local school boards try to struggle with the budget they're given? And we absolutely have an education funding crisis on our hands. And we have a healthcare cost crisis on our hands. And until yesterday, or till a couple days ago, we had a transportation, roads and bridges crisis on our hands. I just want to be as sensitive as I can to local people to come up with their own fix while we're trying to advocate across the state that, you know, taxes are, you know, it's the invisible thing that we're talking about here. But that holds us together. It holds our schools together. It fixes our roads and bridges. It brings us health care that everybody can afford. And, you know, it floats every Minnesotan's boat. But until we get to the place where we can give districts enough money, I'm really worried about painting them into a corner with great ideas like this.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
Very briefly,
is that I had hoped the discussion today, we have talked a lot about why we can't do this. And I had hoped the discussion would be focused on what our children are losing out on, that the people in this room behind me who represent media specialists who have given years of time and really given much to our children, we are losing out on their skills and talents. And that's what I hope the discussion would be. I am certainly aware of unfunded mandates. But I think in bringing this forward, it's very important to note that these positions are the first on the chopping block. And that is truly unfortunate. And it's very disappointing.
Senator Saltzman, at line 1.8, perhaps you'd like to delete the word building.
I would be very open to that.
So as a friendly amendment, Senator Saltzman.
Absolutely. I would be very open to that.
All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Carried. And Senator Saltzman, before you make that motion, just to summarize, we recognize we have a budget crisis in the situation in the state, but that does not stop us from making suggestions as to what we want, what our vision is. We're going to hear a bill from Senator Rummel in the near future on Minnesota Promise. There was a lot of discussion on another subject on roads, transportation. That didn't stop proposals from coming forward until action was finally taken. We'll have a lot of continued discussion on how we finance these, but when students come here spending their day from Humboldt or from Tower Sudan, the staff from Roosevelt, when it's documented, we have problems in Owatonna, Moundsville, Mapleton, across the state, and we're witnessing the dismantling of a program. Perhaps we have an obligation to send a message to the Finance Committee that these are programs that we value. We recognize that it will be the Finance Committee that will process that, but I believe your intent to raise awareness was the intention today, and would request that you make a motion if that's your intent at this point, knowing that it would go to Finance Committee to look at the revised budget that will come from the governor and other considerations in the future. Senator Saltzman, did you want to make a motion?
Yes. I would like to move Senate File 3157 with the amendment that was just passed in this committee.
On Senator Saltzman's motion. Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments, and you're right the fact that we have a budgetary constraint doesn't prevent us from making recommendations. But this is not just, or maybe even primarily, a budget prescription. It is a policy prescription that I think should concern all of us, that we talk often about the importance of local school districts and local school boards as elected officials. And I think the question really has to be asked, if this isn't a decision that is appropriate for a local school district to make, then what is? And I think that as a state legislative body, we should be very reluctant. We may have the power, but I don't know that we should exercise it to become a super school board for the state of Minnesota. And I think that, yes, there are financial concerns for this. Where it falls in the priority of all the things that we have, I don't know. That's something that maybe the Finance Committee can look at. But there is a policy question here, which is, do we supersede, replace, supplant local school districts, local school boards elected by the same constituents that elect us, and say, you are not qualified to make this decision, but we in this room are? And so, Mr. Chairman, I think that let's not make this purely a financial question, but also a policy question. Do we want to trust local districts or not, setting aside the circumstance we have today about whether or not there are funds to do everything we want to do? But it is a policy question, and I think we should treat it as that.
Thank you. Further discussion? Not all in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your time today.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Saltzman, and to the testifiers. And you did raise awareness, and I would not construe that as not supportive of the efforts.
I appreciate that.
Thank you again.
Thank you. We'll go next to Senator Saltzman, and she'll be joined by Senator Olson on Senate File 3156, Effective Literacy Instruction.
Thank you,
I
Mr.
believe
Chair.
There is an author's amendment.
Yes, there is. Well, Senator Olson comes to the table to join me. I would like to move the...
I believe it's the A2.
The A2 amendment, please. It is a delete all amendment.
Okay, this is an author's amendment. A2, all in favor, indicate aye. Opposed? Carried.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may begin by telling you that this is sort of our report to the committee on the work that was done by the early intervention and literacy work group that you appointed earlier this year. And Senator Olson and I have been co-partners in this effort, and I am just honored to have her join me today at the table. I would like to start out by just sharing with you a little background in that we had a hearing last December, and we had 3 hours of testimony, and as a result of that, it was truly parent testimony talking about many of the issues and how children's inability to learn to read is impacting not only them but their families. It was very, very moving testimony, but was the most hopeful piece about that is that we felt we started to hear the answer. We felt that we were on the right track, and as a result of that, this certainly is not the entire solution to a problem, but we believe it's a very good first start. And Senator Torres-Ray, who and Senator Erickson-Rope, who has chaired the Achievement Gap Committee, we believe that this contributes significantly to the work that you're doing. What we'd like to is perhaps to have my co-chair say a few words, but then we'd like to just show you really a DVD that was produced. And Rebecca Schmidt is here. She's behind the pillar. She is a parent advocate, and she took 3 hours of testimony and put it together in a DVD that touches on many different issues. But we'll start out with this one clip here, but I'd like to have Senator Olson say a few words.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Senator Saltzman, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. This has truly been a bipartisan cooperative effort in tackling the issues and challenges to the performance of in learning to read of our young children from K through 3 was the area that we have been focusing on. And I think what has been, this has been a concern of mine over many years, and we know that there have been struggles in this area. We have strong legislation in place, and I think we came through this last session saying we really do mean this. We do want our children, our students, to be able to learn to read at grade level by third grade. We heard it from one of the media specialists. You learn to read up through third grade, and after that, you're reading to learn. And so it's critical. The marvel and the experience that we've had is because it's largely, the movement has largely occurred because of parents who have gone through this experience with their children and have not been able to get the kind of support within the public school system and have sought it outside and found ways to do it. They have kind of they have found one another as well, and they have reinforced, I think, the language of our law and the recognition of the need to strengthen the ability of our teachers to be able to address these issues in a way that will be both satisfying to them as well as productive with the students that they're teaching. But so, I'll stop talking, and it was very moving to hear over a three-hour period. We've condensed it into 28 minutes, and if people want copies, we'll provide them. I shouldn't say we, but our expert has condensed this, but we hope to make this available so that people can hear firsthand some of the things that we learned in that hearing that day.
Senator Olson, just for pacing, how many minutes are we?
It's just a few minutes, and okay. Then we're going to skip. So we're not going to do the whole 28
okay.
minutes.
No.
Just
and
before
it's
you
excellent.
All get up and leave.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, just to preface this, is that we started out with hearing from students about the problem. And then this particular clip talks about the emotional impact on kids when they can't read. And they're not here today, but we want you to hear their stories. Do we need to put the microphone back here?
day could bring tears to me. It was exquisite, painful. And here's an incredibly intelligent child. Everyone is
she's going to figure it out. He was feeling stupid and dumb because from IQ testing that we had done at the Mayo Clinic, he was very intelligent, but yet he, for some unexpected reason, could not learn how to read.
I felt like a lot of my teachers didn't think I was smart, even the reading specialist at school. She told me once in front of the other kids, Emmy, you just need to pick up the pace.
I had a child that was angry and fighting and didn't want to do anything. So there's a huge emotional toll on the child and on the parents.
What I'd like to say is that not being able to read for these kids is awful. I know how it feels.
There's times when I can pass by a particular old playground and panic sets into my stomach.
Because I was one of these kids. And I'm 43 years old and I still have tears.
Acting out is preferable than having other students think that you're dumb. And the problem is, you yourself feel like you're dumb.
He has since told me that he feels he is stupid and dumb. He has been since diagnosed with a reading or an anxiety disorder relating to school, because when he is not in school during the summer, these symptoms go away.
But simply put, when kids don't have their educational needs met in the classroom, more often than not, by no fault of their own, they are made mentally ill.
And when we would try to read with him, he would physically have reaction, and he would get really hot. And so we would be reading very simple books, and by the time we would get to the end, he'd be in his underwear and sweating because he was having a physiological reaction to the stress of trying to do it.
And this one, once bright-eyed, giggling, happy little boy was crying every day, would rather go to bed at 5:30 than struggle getting through his reading.
Homework was taking an hour to an hour and a half each night, ending in tears, frustration for her and for us.
By the middle of second grade, he would come home from school, throw his backpack across the floor, and he would crawl up under our dining room table and sit in the fetal position. He didn't want to do homework. He was fighting at home. I was losing my child.
That was very powerful testimony, and so we wanted to share that with you because those are the stories that continue to move us forward in proposing this legislation. One of the things that we have in statute right now is that we have defined comprehensive scientific-based reading instruction, and that we believe that there is reliable evidence showing that these programs can really improve student achievement. So in our bill, starting on line 117, we've gone a step further to take the definitions from the National Reading Panel define specifically what these five strands mean. We then move on, and probably the piece in this legislation that is probably the most profound is that we have been looking at how can we ensure that teachers in our schools have these skills. And we've heard repeatedly in going across the state in talking to school districts that teachers are seeking retraining to make sure that they are really trained in these five strands. And these five strands, as defined, are then phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary development, and also reading comprehension. So we've heard these stories, but we've also heard from young teachers who are just coming from our colleges that they really didn't feel prepared to teach these specific skills with their students. And what's important to note is that we believe that if we can intervene earlier, identify kids earlier who are struggling to read and start to intervene, we can prevent children from having these kinds of experiences.
By preventing these experiences, we also feel that it'll have an impact on the amount of resources that it's taking when at third grade most of the identification and the special services of special education begin. The need to learn to read and address these is before that time. And while this may not be the answer to everything, it clearly, from the experiences that parents have had in working with their children who are struggling readers, that if we can better equip our teachers in our schools to deliver on the multitude and serve the variety of needs of individual students that they are doing now and do that more effectively, that we will be able to reduce that demand for special education services, particularly in our fastest growing areas, and that is the learning disabilities and the emotional behavior. And I think the clip that Senator Saltzman has shown shows that there's a link there. And we believe that the evidence is strong enough that good, solid reading instruction on all five strands is going to make a great deal of difference.
If you want to look at line 2.7, what we are
2.7
is that
on the delete all.
Excuse me?
On the delete all.
Right. On the delete all, 2.7, that we have in statute now that the Board of Teaching must require our teacher colleges to include these teaching strategies in their curriculum. And we have no doubt that the colleges do have these in their syllabi and are teaching them. But what we want to make sure is that the students are competent in order to be able to implement these strategies as they become beginning teachers. Now, certainly teachers need staff development, and we are not trying to say that people come out, you know, of college as an expert. But when you think about reading and the fact that we've heard from, you know, some of the schools that we have visited during the past year, and you've been with us for some of those visits and some of the site visits that we've had, we've heard from like beginning teachers and also from principals that they're having to send teachers off to a literacy workshop for 3, 4, 5 days before they can really enter the classroom for the first time. And we've heard from teachers, and certainly we can debate whether or not how this impacted them, but why are we spending thousands of dollars to retrain and train teachers in what we believe are some of the most effective reading strategies? We have done extensive research, and we are proposing what is being done in Massachusetts right now, in that they're requiring a person to successfully complete a reading instruction competency test before they're able to be licensed. Now, right now, the Praxis test, we understand, which is required for teaching, has 120 questions. 10 of those deal with reading. And you could flunk all of those questions and still teach in a public school. So we believe that, you know, reading is so important that there should be a separate test. We have outlined that test and described it on page 4.3. And we are suggesting that the assessment must have been previously administered in another state for over 5 years and be composed of multiple choice and constructive response questions designed to measure reading instruction, knowledge, and skills, and also assess content areas in foundation of reading, development of reading comprehension, reading assessment and instruction, and integration of knowledge and understanding. We heard this morning in the E-12 committee about, you know, that Massachusetts is a model. They have done some extraordinary things. And while this test alone is not going to improve, you know, teaching, it's going to raise the bar to make sure. And we are asking that this test be implemented in 2010, which would allow time for our teacher colleges to ensure that they are prepared in teaching our you know, on the pre-service teachers in these skills. Do you want to add anything?
Just hitchhiking on what Senator Saltzman has said at the hearing in the budget division this morning, the folks that have been working on developing Minnesota's Promise, one of the models they have looked to is Massachusetts. It's a state that we regret to say is ahead of us.
And they've done some broad approaches. This is one area that they have had some emphasis. And one thing that intrigued me that Mr. Peckle raised was that as a result of the efforts they have done in improving their teacher preparation and quality, they are attracting even more competent people to the teaching profession. And I think that's a concern that we face into the future. And so strengthening what we do and the preparation of our teachers is going to improve their satisfaction and, I believe, ultimately some retention as well.
We've also added to this bill something that we think is sort of interesting and we hope worthy of a further discussion is that while we have asked for the test to be implemented in 2010, we would like to see the test identified and then offered as a pilot project for the next 2 years so that students in college could take a pretest, and then we would also we suggest a program where they would be offered scholarships to be able to be tutored in some of these skills and take a post-test. So that we also heard this morning about in Massachusetts that when they had their math and reading test that they had the test, you know, they provided the test for 2 years to get information, sort of some background on are we testing to this level, and being able to give us some good feedback on what areas are we deficient in, what areas are we doing well in. But that is obviously a program that would need you know, funding. We are proposing that it be a public-private match. We hear repeatedly from business that, you know, if we see a program that we think is truly going to make a difference, we're willing to invest in that. So we suggest that this is something that we think is very important, and we'll be hearing just a little bit later from some of these alternative programs that have been highly effective. So that is essentially the bill. There is one more piece at the end that we also are also requesting is that the Board of Teaching currently has a work group that is working on changing some of the reading standards for teachers, and we are then asking that the proposed rules cannot be adopted as rules until legislative committees having jurisdiction over K-12 have approved the proposed rules. We've heard a lot about reading wars. I like to think of it that we're all moving down the same road together and that we may have differences of opinion on the strategies, but I think it's important for us to be sort of the folks who listen to what's going on, what do these rules look like. We absolutely have to make sure that these most effective reading strategies are involved. At this point, I'd like to just watch the rest, just a little bit more of this tape. And one thing that I think was very important at this hearing is that the parents who came and testified, you're going to, like you heard about the issues, at the end it talks about the success stories, about how their children were able to read. But what many of them said was, in order for my child to read, I had to go outside our public schools, I had to find tutors and special programs. My child was able, really saw a difference, but not every child can. And money and time should not make a difference on whether a child learns to read. So I commend the parents, many of them are here today, who came, and they weren't just speaking about their child. They were speaking for all children. So this next clip talks a little bit about their, you know, that sort of message, and also then a little bit more about the teacher preparation, which I think is very important for you to hear as well.
So that I can learn from that.
And the cost to our society in the on a personal level and a larger economic level is huge. And it's just simply unacceptable that we have numbers of 37% of our students reading at proficient levels.
Really, we're here because we think the problem can get solved.
It is not hard to figure out who these kids are. You can see it in kindergarten through district-wide screening. You use the data. You look at the students. You don't look at the families they come from. You don't look at the language spoken at home. You don't look at the color of their skin.
But there's a heck of a lot of people who are not in this room today who, you know, are completely unable, and I think we really have a social obligation to try to bring this diversity of learning systems into the schools and make them available for those kids.
And it is our responsibility
as the adults in this community to give all children the opportunity to learn to read, because it is their right.
I don't want it to have to be about luck and about money. And so I guess what I really learned today is that I hope something's done sooner than later.
So at the time, I was going to Winona State University to get my elementary ed and my special ed licensures, which I do have. In those classes, I never learned anything about how to teach reading, ever. In order to pick or design appropriate curriculum for classrooms, it is profoundly important that teachers have training that they need. Our son was in a reading program for 3 years that the manufacturer rep told us was inappropriate to meet my son's needs. It's important for the teachers to have the absolute understanding of what the language is, how it's structured, so they can identify when the kids are having problems in a way that they can intervene with it before it becomes a lifelong problem. And we actually taught those students, 30 of them per year, it's a year-long graduate credit course still going on, how to teach reading. And those teachers said that they were ready to drop out of education program because it was worthless until they took our class.
And I think the thing that we hear overwhelmingly in our evaluations from the teachers is why haven't I learned this in my undergrad programs?
We are teaching them the structure of the English language. And many of those teachers said, why didn't I ever learn this before?
For the sake of the state and the sake of the whole educational system, it's really important to realize that we need to make the investment in certifying our teachers.
You know, it doesn't seem fair that the school district should have to pay for it when the teacher should be coming in knowing how to do it ahead of time.
I know everyone today is saying like 30%. If you have about 30% of kids in every classroom, it's not a small number, and that the teachers really should know how to deal with such a large number of students.
What would a child say? Well, this is Kitty. He's learned Kitty. But an underlying structure rule of the language is that C before I, E, or Y always says. So we have to teach this explicitly as well. Teachers coming out of our programs don't know this.
You see on the chart, those kids don't fail in reading. They don't have to, and they shouldn't have to, because they should be honored as learners.
Underlying structures of language are not being addressed in our teacher education programs. I can say that unequivocally.
It's mainly learning the structure of the language, because if teachers don't know the sounds, the correct sounds that the language makes, if they don't know that those sounds map to letters, it'll be very hard for them to teach children how to read.
And I'll tell you, of those, the 60% not reading at proficiency, only 10% of them will have a diagnosed learning disability, a reading disability. 90% of our kids who are not reading at grade level are instructional casualties. Instructional casualties. Okay, and until we correct that, and until our higher ed sees that and does something about it, we are doomed.
We want you to know we have a little announcement to make here. You've seen you've had the preview, but today this DVD named The Right to Read is available on YouTube.
Okay.
So just hit The Right to Read and you can watch the 28-minute the full whatever.
Senator Olson, how many times have you promoted the YouTube for your testimony?
This is a first, and I thank Senator Saltzman for allowing me to do that.
Okay.
Well, and we're also on YouTube, as we have an intro to this tape, which we didn't bore you with today. You know, I do want to note that our higher education institutes are our partners in this, that if we, as we've talked about the achievement gap, we talk continuously about schools and school districts and the legislature and money, but we want to partner with our higher ed institutes as well. This is a difficult discussion, and our schools are doing a tremendous job Too often, though, we are seeing that many of these strategies are taught as a graduate class in special education. And if a child is going to get these kind of instruction strategies in a special ed program, we've failed, in that we should be intervening earlier. I have two other people to testify briefly, Susan Thompson, who is a parent advocate, who you saw on the tape, and Bette Erickson, who is also a parent advocate. You have seen Bette here before with her daughter, Mackenzie, speaking about special education. I'd like Susan to give a little bit of background, because the Board of Teaching is also looking at teacher standards right now, and I'd like her just to give a brief update if she would be willing to do that.
Sure, thank you. I'm a parent advocate that's been serving on the Board of Teaching Task Force for the past year, and there are many other members on the task force that are here. And before I jump into that, I really want to emphasize my motivation in dedicating my time over this past year, which has been really almost a full-time job, is it comes with deep passion. I have five teachers, either retired or working as full-time teachers in public schools. I come from a family where two of the kids had strong struggles, but we were lucky. You know, I could quit my job, I could move to the right district, I could spend the money, and they are very, very successful students right now. But do you know what really motivates me? What motivates me is when I look at the NAEP scores and I look at the fact that Minnesota has one of the highest achievement gaps in the country, I nearly break into tears, because I look at these kids and I think they don't have probably a strong parent advocate like me who could quit her job. They don't have the financial resources that can hire the private tutor. And they don't have the choice of leaving their home district and selecting a district and moving into a home. So please know that I feel privileged to work on the task force. I've been working with a lot of members of higher ed. They've worked extremely hard with me. And the situation is this. We've worked for a year, and we're working very hard to try to get out of committee some proposals, some rule proposals, and it is extremely hard. We have tremendous controversy. We have a great facilitator, Karen Balmer. She's been remarkable. But we don't have recommendations out of committee because there's strong controversy. We're trying to get them out. Our goal is to get them to the board by April. And then we'd go into an administrative law process for 18 months, and then we'd, you know, conversation back to higher ed about conforming to the new rule. So in my simple mind, we've been working hard for a year. I think we will produce some rule. The rule will end up reaching reality, reaching our schools with these new teachers trained in a different program in about 2014. So from my perspective, that's why I, as a parent, I'm calling out to the legislators to support the rulemaking process. Because the reality is, the rulemaking process is a good process. It'll bring change in 2014. But before that, we need change. And I will tell you two things that this legislation is absolutely dramatically important to, is that it will help correct the inadequacy of the Praxis 0014 tests that our current elementary teachers take. It does not provide enough questions to evaluate whether our candidates have competent knowledge in how to teach reading. So all we want to do is take what is a good reading statute in Minnesota law and make it better. Instead of just requiring that instruction and exposure and application of knowledge happen, we want you to raise the bar so our wonderful teacher candidates come forward with a minimum level of competency. So this legislation could do that. The second thing is, and I'll be very brief, is I spent many, many days looking at the syllabi that are on record at the Board of Teaching. The Board of Teaching does a great job. They monitor compliance with the reading statute. Our higher ed, 28 institutions, are in compliance with the reading statute. But if we raise the bar, position would be we need more time in the undergraduate program dedicated to the teaching of reading. Only 5% of the undergraduate curriculum right now is on the topic of teaching reading. So if we raise the bar, hopefully we'll empower many of the higher ed staff people here to message back to their institutions that we'd like more time in the undergraduate curriculum on the teaching of reading. Thank you.
Thank you. And please state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Bette Erickson, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to support this issue today. And to the Senators Salzman and Olson that have worked so diligently and heartfelt on this proposal on behalf of the children of Minnesota. I'm really here to give a voice to the children who are our next generation. Think of those toddlers that you know in your life. Because when they hit kindergarten and first grade, if this proposal or this amendment goes into statute or to law, those children will have teachers in their kindergarten, first, second, and third grade classes who know how to teach them how to read. I was a parent that was trained as an elementary education teacher, and I wasn't taught how to teach children to read. I was taught to go into a classroom, manage a classroom, put together a classroom, and pick up the reading curriculum that was offered in the classroom. But when I had students that didn't respond because of their learning style to that curriculum, I had no tools in my toolbox. And when my own daughter struggled to read, I found that I needed tools and desperately. And I went out and was retrained at higher level skills to teach reading specifically to students who struggle with reading. And these are bright, capable, smart, engaging, delightful children that I have the privilege of working with. And they are in their classrooms. They're going to first grade. I have a little first grader who says, Mommy, now I'm going to start to learn how to read. Am I going to go to first? I mean, they want to read. That's what elementary school is about. And we are really here promoting specific instruction and direct instruction and strategies in the five strands for kindergarten through third grade. We know that the teachers have a lot of training and do an excellent job in teaching comprehension skills and vocabulary development and literacy, but we're talking about how do I learn how to read? And we have students in the state of Minnesota, 27% of our students are reading at a fourth grade below basic level. We have above proficiency, we have proficiency, we have basic, and we have below basic. One out of four children, if they're not reading by third grade, they're going to become illiterate. I mean, they're illiterate. They're not going to succeed in school. They're going to drop out. They're going to check out. They're going to cause trouble. They're going to live lives in poverty or less than their expectations. The chances of them graduating from high school and going on to post high school opportunities, I mean, it's just a cost that we can't afford it in this state, if for no other reason. The other thing I want to point out is that teachers really do not feel prepared to teach reading. I work in a elementary school in Minneapolis, and we have teachers that we've offered an after-school training program to. Our newest teacher is a first-year teacher. Our most experienced teacher is an 18-year teacher. We tend to have teachers in the building in a range that's on a little bit on the higher end because it's a desirable school to teach in, socioeconomically an advantaged school in the Minneapolis Public Schools. We offered them 9 hours of after-school training to learn how to teach children to read, kindergarten through second grade teachers. They 9 hours showed up after school. We served snacks and coffee. And they learned skills that they had never learned in their 4 years of undergraduate work. Most of them had masters. Most of them were on track for had masters or were on track from it. Never had learned basic skills on the structure of the language. Never knew how important it was to teach elementary kindergartners and first graders phonemic awareness skills. Never knew what systematic instruction or direction to approach phonics in and what letters and sounds to teach first and how to bring that into a multi-sensory classroom. We also surveyed teachers from that had taken advantage of a Minnesota Reading First program. 27% of teachers felt prepared to teach reading based on their initial licensure training. So they're going into classrooms, they don't feel like they're prepared to teach reading, they're meeting students who aren't learning to read, and nobody knows what to do. 86% of these same teachers reported reading improvement in their classroom after they were trained on and implemented teaching of the five strands of reading in their classroom. So these teachers are, I mean, I love education. I love teachers. These teachers really want to do a good job, and they really want to teach kids to read. They know that in those first years, that's the most basic challenge that they have. But they simply don't have the skills in their toolbox. And they don't, unfortunately, many of them, until they've got exposure to this training, they don't even know what they don't know. And so when you're coming to them as a parent wanting to help and wanting answers for your child, they often don't have the answers. So I really urge you to look at this legislation seriously, to know how important it is for our children out there who absolutely have to be able to read, and for our teachers. We really want to support teachers, and we really need everybody to partner on this because it's the only way we're going to move forward in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll ask if there's questions by the committee, and also note that there are some others in the audience that would like to raise some questions. Senator Hatton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Saltzman, I really commend you and Senator Olson for doing this, bringing this forward. I think this is a very important initiative that we should undertake. And I remember even a year ago when we first began to hear the presentations on Reading First and the other ideas on enhancing literacy, and it just reminds me back when I was on the school board and negotiating one year and talking with the student, with the teacher representatives, and we were having a discussion about education, and they said, I wish we could get better focused on the things that make the most difference. And one of the teachers said, I think if we just put everything we had into making sure that all kids could read at fourth grade level when they got out of fourth grade, that would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it really would. In my own case, my son, who's now a freshman in college in second grade, got through second grade, could not read. And we had just implemented in our district a new curriculum that was more of a kind of a whole language approach, and that works for some. But it didn't work for him, and he couldn't read. And we had to do some things, and we did change the curriculum in the district. But this is very important. I think it's so fundamental. You can't do anything in education without that reading skill. And I just really appreciate the work that you have done, both of you, to bring this forward. And I look forward to seeing this get on a fast track and getting done. So thank you for doing that. And thanks for the testimony we've had today, too.
In order of the hands, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Saltzman, I have a couple of questions. One is, they're kind of technical. I'm not clear as to how these will work. And I don't know if anybody from higher education is here or have worked with your committee. If I understand this correctly, this is a process to conduct an assessment and do the pretest to kind of measure the skill. But how does this connect then with the actual training and instruction that the teachers receive? So the assessment is good, the testing is good, but if we don't have a plan in place to work with the teachers to make sure that they get there, what is the use of it?
A very good question, Senator Torres-Ray.
And I'm curious with respect to the language you have in page 5, subdivision 4. You said the commissioner in cooperation with the testing contractor. So is this kind of an additional body that is created to do the assessment? And how do they coordinate with the actual institutions that educate teachers? I'm kind of a little confused about the layers. So we have the institutions that train teachers, and we have a contractor testing. And then what happens after they are tested? Could you explain that to me, please?
Absolutely. I think I want to go back, and first of all, I think your first question was about how this all fits together, correct? We are proposing that the actual test, in order to become licensed, would begin in July of 2010, so two years from this July. Currently, right now, we have in statute that the Board of Teaching will only approve and license our higher ed institutes, and have them, I believe the word is it accredited? If they meet these standards. And frankly, given some of the discussion and some of just the non-scientific research that we've done, but it's pretty consistent, we could be pointing fingers right now and saying, you're not doing this. But we would prefer to come forward and look at this in a positive way of saying, we believe that we want to make everyone aware of what our expectations are. As a legislature, we have put in statute that these reading strategies are important, and we expect teachers to not only be taught them, but to be competent in them. And that's what this test does. We are giving higher education 2 years that if there's any concerns that their students are not receiving this kind of instruction, they have 2 years to look at their curriculum. If I were a higher ed institute this summer, and I think that there's been some discussion of a proposal of why doesn't the legislature fund all of the higher ed colleges coming together and reviewing their syllabi and talking about how they're going to do this. Frankly, why aren't they doing this? You know, why should we be funding? This is what students are paying tuition for. This is what we're funding in higher education. And that's where I go back to stakeholders. And look at our schools are tested every year. We put their scores in the newspaper. Our schools are being held accountable for reading and all these things. And what we're suggesting is that we believe higher ed is also our partner. So in terms of working with higher education, we've already given them, I guess you could say, a mandate several years ago that this is very important. So this test in 2010 is the high bar. What we looked at was we felt like a sense of urgency. And this thing of, well, we don't want to wait, because every year we wait, there's another class of kids moving through. So to sort of nudge this along was we thought of, what if we could use this test for a couple years as sort of a practice test? And then we looked at the fact that many teachers in our state who are teaching now are going off to these workshops. They're going off to the Reading Center in Rochester. They're going off to Groves Academy. There's the Sonday program. We're not picking specific schools or like specific programs. SCRED, which we funded the RTI Center for, is looking at linking with Voyager University with an online program to work with not only online but then a practicum. We look at possibilities of we have the Minnesota Reading Corps, which is where we have all these students who aren't reading. How could we look at alternative ways? You might think of it as charter schools for literacy. Now, we're not proposing all of that in this bill, but what we are saying is that, teachers who are going through higher ed, if we have a student who wants to see if they're competent in these skills, because this is what our principals want, to be able to take this pre-test and post-test and be able to go back to their higher ed institute and say, look it, I did great, or look it, I didn't do so well. And maybe that would be good feedback for higher ed to help them if they need to restructure their, you know, curriculum before the 2010 test.
We're not trying to reorganize the Board of Teaching. The Board of Teaching handles this process, but its authority and direction is given by the legislature. They have rulemaking authority by that, and they essentially work to carry out the policies that the legislature sets. We see this as another example of kind of reinforcing the instruction for teaching reading at the early grades as a directive and a guide to them as they are in fact shaping their rules. They're in that process of working toward that. We would like to be partners again to see that process is going forward in a strong direction that addresses the concerns that you've heard both on the video and here at the table. And the idea of starting now with, you know, not a high stakes, but rather one of the pre-test, the sample test, letting people take that and assess where they are. And then working to find some ways, if they are still, I will go beyond it. I don't think our language addresses it specifically, but not just for the candidates that are about to graduate and go into the classroom, But as you've heard, there are a lot of classroom teachers out there that are feeling inadequate. Do we have that in there?
We do have
okay. That it's also for current teachers to be able to determine and assess where they are and what needs they have. And we would like to make some grants available, grants or scholarships. That's where Senator Saltzman was talking about raising some funds. If we could put up some seed money and draw in money outside of it from enterprises that are businesses and others that realize how important this is to the success of the people that they hope will become part of their work establishment or professions or anywhere else, we need to work on both fronts, both the pre-service as well as those who are teaching now, and help them get up to speed. And there are programs out there that can do that, and we believe higher education has the capability of putting these in place as well. But we don't want to close the door on any option that is effective in doing this in preparing them. And then for relicensure or for their first licensure, that's what we're working toward, an assessment that measures that and will give a greater reassurance that the teachers are prepared to tackle this very important, the most important in our view, skill that is learned in the early elementary grades.
And so to your second point on Subdivision 4, Senator Torres-Ray, the passing score is that if you think about this, is that the test is developed by a testing company and that the commissioner will select the test best based on the criterion that is in this bill. So that's the testing contractor. Like you look at the tests that we give now in the state, they have a testing contractor. And I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in this area, but they would be able to look at some of these scores over 2 years to determine what is a cut score or a passing score. And that also is grounds for debate. But if we just wanted to include that you then determine what is a passing score on the test. And plus, the other thing to look at is that while this pretest is going on, we're going to have an opportunity to hear how these tests are going. And that may spur other policy discussions as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Follow up, Senator Torres-Ray.
One more thing that I wanted to ask. With respect to cultural competence, I'm quite concerned that this is an important issue for teachers that are teaching very young kids, and we have a growing number of children that are pre-K from these ages that are the ages we're talking about in this particular proposal. And so I would like to offer an amendment to the bill that may incorporate some language that attends to that particular need. Mm-hmm. And it's on page 4. You have subdivision 2C. And I would like to suggest that we incorporate the words cultural competence after knowledge. And so that it will read, the Minnesota Reading Instructions Competence Assessment must measure the knowledge, cultural competence, skill, and ability of pre-kindergarten, et cetera. To address some of the issues around really understanding particularly language needs.
Senator Torres-Ray, it moves that at line 4.4. After the word knowledge, comma, that we insert cultural competence, comma. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman?
Correct.
Senators Olson and
Saltzman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, how would you define that?
When
Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Olson, it is my understanding that when you are dealing with young children and preparing them and teaching them the reading skill, some children may not have English as their primary language, but the ability to read is an ability that they learn, and it could be done in their native language. And so that in transitioning children and teaching them and learning the process, you could do it in a kind of dual language system. in which you really continue to enhance their ability to read in their native language and then transition them into English. This is particularly important for children that enter kindergarten and their native language is not English. And we have, I have visited a number of schools where children are not making sufficient progress in English, but they thrive when they had the they have the ability to work with a teacher that speaks their language, and they are able to use books and different mechanisms to help them kind of get in the process of acquiring the language in kind of a, in a dual system. I am not an expert in it, but I understand that it is significant, particularly for young children that enter kindergarten and they don't speak, you know, English is not their native language. And so there is a really a need for the teacher to understand how they can do this and how they can manage the classroom, especially now that we have more than one or two children in the classroom that don't speak English.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we have in the audience some of the people that I have heard that have used many of these strategies in teaching English as a second language. But I have heard reports that they have been effective in doing it very rapidly because the structure of the language, just as we need to learn when we're learning another language, we need to understand that structure in order to be able to start building on it with the comprehension and using it. And that is exactly what this helps children learn the language, I think, more rapidly, because they're learning that structure of language. And I don't want to underestimate anybody, regardless of what their background is, in terms of their abilities to learn to read using these kinds of strategies and with that kind of background knowledge. I'm not sure, I'm not sure I totally understand what you mean if we're talking about trying to have every teacher be a bilingual teacher. But because that's what it was sounding like, because I'm not sure that that is essential in this, but we should continue that discussion so that we have greater understanding of it.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Torres Ray, Senator Saltzman.
Address that also is that this test is based on what we already have in state statute that defines what scientific research-based read instruction is. Mm-hmm. So it's based on a set of very specific definitions as defined. And until I think we would have what would be the standards for testing, what are we requiring right now? Because we're saying we're requiring our higher education institutions to do this. I am not sure if we're requiring what you're asking already our higher ed institutes to do. So that's why I think it's a very, very important discussion. But I don't know that it fits with this language in this bill, because I don't know how you would, because you base a test based on what your outcomes are going to be. What are you trying to test? And until we define that very specifically, what is cultural competence, how do we test for it? But I think that's an excellent discussion, and I would join you in looking at that issue.
Mr. Chair. Senator
Torres-Ray.
Senator Saltzman. I think one of the issues, this is really a critical issue, particularly for reading. And I do think that to Senator Olson's concern, the issue is not having really teachers who speak both languages and requiring that, but having the ability to understand what is language acquisition. And to do that, you don't have to speak both languages, but perhaps understand the child's need to communicate. Mm-hmm. And it is so important that teachers learn that and that teachers understand that, and many do, and they are not bilingual. And they understand that, you know, they understand how to manage this particular process. So I do think that we have an opportunity to incorporate this language so that we can start thinking about what that means and how do we train teachers within a cultural context that today it is imperative in the classroom. So it's really enhancing their ability, but you know, we can talk, because to me, this is an opportunity for us to talk about it, and to have it in the bill right now will give us exactly that opportunity to say, well, how does this work?
Well, I would
ask Senator Saltzman, on the amendment.
I'd like to wait on that amendment until, you know, as this bill moves forward, and continue the conversation, because we would need to define what cultural competence is. And until we have that defined, I don't know how we would be able to test for that. So to do that, I think that, if this bill does move forward, I think to talk about that, or is that something, yes, and absolutely work with you to ensure that we're...
Would you be willing to withdraw at this point the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We have questions from Senator Lynch, Senator Erickson Ropes, and we have two other bills. We won't get to the Department of Ed bill. And maybe it's because I always want to hear all of your bills when you come, and the downside is that we have a lot of committee time ahead of us. But we won't hear the Department of Ed bill today. It's the intent that we continue discussion on Senator Saltzman and Olson's proposal for 15 more minutes, and if we need to lie that over to continue in the near future. But I'd like Senator Rummel to be able to present her bill, and that we would adjourn no later than 5:55. Is that okay with committee members? Is that okay? Okay, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, that look was knowing that I'm going into Senator Marty's committee at 5:59, but it's okay. Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson, good work. Good work. And thank you, testifiers, for helping to bring forward the evidence that supports this proposal. When there are 1 out of 4 children in the state of Minnesota that are experiencing difficulty, we can't afford not to do something. And this committee traveled quite extensively during the interim. We visited a number of districts all across the state of all sizes and shapes, of all socioeconomic demographics. And we saw this in every district that we went to. We also heard from some districts that they recognized the need and they were seeking to address this issue, in some cases sending their teachers to places like Ohio State University to get this training. I wanted to just make a comment about Minnesota teachers, though, because we focus an awful lot today on curriculum, as is appropriate in this bill. But I know Senator Saltzman and Senator Olson and I share the notion that it's not exclusively all about the curriculum, rather that it's really that partnership between giving the teachers the tools that they need and the background and the education that they need to be able to do what they need to do with all of our students. I feel particularly impassioned about this because I, too, had the poster child of the struggling reading student in first grade. And I knew the importance of making sure that that child was able to read at grade level by the end of second grade. I have the privilege in this body to serve on the Higher Ed Committee, and I look forward to continuing to work with you as you move forward.
Thank you. Senator Erickson Ropes, could I ask if you could hold on the question for a few minutes? I would like to hear from the other side on this issue, and I believe there's at least a few people, so if they could please approach the table. And, yes, and please state your name for the record, Ms. Palmers.
Good afternoon, Senator Wieger and committee members. My name is Karen Ballmer. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Board of Teaching. I don't know if you would call me the other side exactly. I do come with a great deal of context and comments that I want to provide for the committee this afternoon. I think the easiest way probably to do it is to take you briefly section by section, and I think that will help to consolidate.
Perhaps just
comments.
The big picture. Do you support the bill?
We, as you've noted and heard, we have a process that we are going through. I think it needs to be very clear that the Board of Teaching is in lockstep spirit with the intent of this bill in terms of improving what we do and strengthening what we, how our teachers are prepared to serve our students. You won't hear from the Board of Teaching that we don't need to do anything more in the area of reading. You won't hear that. And that's exactly why we have a task force that's been working for about a year, as you've heard. So I'll just keep my comments to, I think, section one, the definitions. I'll defer to the experts who are the reading in our reading community for those. Sections 2 through 4, where it talks about the assessment, we've had a little conversation about it. Context, I think, is really critical for you as committee members. Pre-service teachers right now in statute are required to take two series of tests. The first is a basic skills test, and there are three components: the reading, writing, and mathematics. So that's series one. We call it Praxis One, the basic skills. And then there's a second series, which consists of two longer tests. One is content specific to their licensure field, and the other is a pedagogy test specific to the ages that they're going to be taking. So that, I think, is important context as you think about layering on an additional assessment, what those students already in pre-service are required to do, and the cost and so on of that. What we do on the licensing end is when licensure standards are developed, so for example, math teachers, there are math standards that are developed. A test is then selected on the basis of aligning with those standards. What the Board of Teaching is doing by redoing and redesigning and rewriting our licensure standards, by definition, we will have to then change our tests and the assessments that we have. We know that our tests are currently deficient. You won't hear disagreement about that. We need more and better questions on our elementary tests and others. So what we'll do in our process is we will redesign those rules for new standards. Tests will then be aligned to those standards, and they will reflect those standards that the board has set into rule. The one caution I do want to throw out in terms specifically to the language in Section 4, when it talks on line 4.7 about an assessment having been previously administered in another state, just so you know, the world of testing, when these are in my knowledge of other tests in other states, these other states own the tests. We may want to be careful about language in terms of being modeled after other states, but I don't know that we could use another state's test. That would certainly require further investigation on our end. Let me just end with Section 7, which talks about the rules coming before all education committees. Here again, please. Let me be very clear that we have no problem with, and in fact, we embrace the opportunity to be very transparent, very engaged, very collaborative in our work. From a pure policy standpoint, outside of reading or any other policy issue that comes to the Board of Teaching, I do have strong concerns about that language, that every time the board would try to move on an initiative, we would have to go through that this would crack the door open, possibly for having us to move all of our policy discussions through the legislature. We do want to be collaborative. We have had legislators as a part of our process, and we will continue to do that from a pure policy standpoint. We do have concerns about what that language might mean for us in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson, could we see if there's anyone else that would like to testify, and then we'll ask the authors to...
I was just going to respond to these maybe points and comment.
Okay. That's fine. A short response?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the legislature has, in fact, passed standards in the past and directed them to be the basis for moving forward, both with the preparation of teachers. And this isn't meant to be that ominous. We just want to try to maintain consistency and be able to review
as you're going forward, it looks like the progress that you're being made, that might even be able to be happen before we end this session, to have that dialogue and increase the comfort level here, and then let's send you marching on your way through that rulemaking process, because that's not our intent to disrupt, but we want to see that strengthened. And it isn't a content area. Reading, to me, isn't a content area. It's an underlying skill that is important to learning virtually all the other content areas.
Okay.
So that's why I think we place such a high priority and believe that it deserves the kind of attention that it is getting.
And there is a test available that meets these criteria.
Okay. Thanks. And we have another person in the audience to address, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. My name is Deborah Dillon. I'm a professor of research in reading at the University of Minnesota, and I'm also a parent in the Edina School District of a 10-year-old. And I've been participating in the Board of Teaching work, and I wanted to just briefly speak to alleviating your fears or worries about that particular work, and also just noting that we are collaborating with a number of different stakeholders representing teachers, researchers, parents from across the state of Minnesota in this work. I think what's really important to note that a process is in place with the Board of Teaching Reading Task Force, and I would like to respectfully ask that this work be allowed to continue its course of action, because I think it's going to result in something excellent, something that from a researcher's point of view and looking nationwide at what's going on is going to be making a mark in the nation. This process is going to be able to lay out the knowledge that new teachers need to know about how to teach reading to all children in Minnesota. It's also going to talk about what specialized knowledge we need to support classroom teachers who are doing their very best teaching all children, providing interventions for all children, but when children need something extra, what that would be. And this process and this document that we're working on is going to play that out. The second thing that's really important to note is that these standards that we're creating, as Karen Ballmer mentioned, are going to then dictate the kind of assessments that would be appropriate to be able to show that teachers have the knowledge and the skills to be able to implement good reading instruction. And I have all confidence that we will be able to create an assessment that's appropriate for the state of Minnesota and our standards. And this would be part of this process that would occur after we've created the standards in a timely fashion. And that brings me to the last point, and that is we've heard passionate conversation from a very strong, passionate group of parents who certainly have worked hard to make sure that we understand what's going on with students, that they really care about their children. And I want them to know on behalf of the education community that we hear them and that we're prepared to work very hard to make sure that these standards certainly address those needs and that we're preparing teachers to meet the needs of all children. And we will hold ourselves accountable for that very thing. And lastly, the Board of Teaching process has been characterized somewhat as not being able to occur in a timely fashion. And I just don't believe that's true. There are things happening right now in higher ed. I've been part of a grant that was funded by the Bush Foundation to be able to pull higher ed together to talk about how we can develop more consistency in the way teachers are prepared. And you have our pledge that we're going to continue to work forward in that area.
Thank you, Professor Dillon. I'm going to ask Eric Naumann, in reviewing the A2 amendment, had some comments which are for the author's consideration.
Mr. Chairman and members, I was asked to speak with Council of State and Local Government Committee on Section 7. The concern with this section, according to Council, is that this would create a subgroup of legislators that was creating law and that's considered to be unconstitutional. His opinion is if it remains in the bill, that state and local would need to take a look at it.
So I could ask the authors if they want to disarm Section 7, or we could have that discussion later.
So
whether it's debatable.
Perhaps a question, Mr. Naumann. Are there any suggestions on how to of how the legislature could how we could sort of keep our finger in what's happening with the Board of Teaching, particularly in this area?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, not having spent the money to go to law school, I'm a little bit out of my league here, but I think that the State and Local Government Committee would be more than happy to give advice on that point.
Okay.
If you felt so inclined. Council was in committee, and he did say to me that generally what we tend to do in cases like this is say that it doesn't go into effect until such time as the legislature has taken a look at it. I think that's okay, but I'm not the expert in this area.
Mr. Chairman,
I think that even the notion of review versus approved might do that. I think that is the general idea, or whether it's that at that point in the process. I think we've had it in several different kinds of wording, but we could certainly adapt that and talk with the folks at state and local government to modify that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think they're going to be more than happy to take a look at this given the conversation I just had with council. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Hannon, and I think we're close to entertaining a motion.
I wanted to just give some advice on this. If it were changed to be the legislature rather than a legislative committee, we've done things similar to that in the past where we required the legislature to approve, and that could be done. Would that pass muster as far as if we wanted to preserve this? I guess what I'm hearing you say is that if we leave this in, it's likely going to make a trip to another committee to take a look at this language. And if we take the language out or modify in some way, that it may avoid that. And I'm just wondering if we, instead of having this refer to a legislative committee to the whole legislature for approval, would that not pass the constitutional muster?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hann, again, I'm not the expert in this. I heard two concerns from council. Number one, that we had a subgroup of legislators, and number two, that we were having a formal review over it, a second, in a sense, blessing it. That his language was that generally what we do in cases like this is say that the effect is delayed, or that it doesn't become effective until such time as the legislature looks at it. And there was a bunch of legal jargon that he threw at me, too, that I didn't quite catch. But I think if you struck it, that's one option. It gets you to finance right away. If you leave it in some form, it would be, I think, fair to say that Senator Rest's committee would want to take a look at it.
Okay.
So just a technical question. Will this move to finance before it would perhaps go to Senate Rest Committee? Could we continue to work on that, or do we need to work on this right now?
It can be referred to finance. Okay, I did speak to Senator Stump, and of course Senator Rest can request it as well, and anyone else deeming jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
Senator Stump.
I think it probably would be better to go to Senator Rest Committee first and then finance after that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to suggest the reviewed?
Maybe have it worked on and have an amendment for them. Okay. So if this might take care of it, but we're not sure, instead of approved, to have reviewed, but I'm not sure that we want.
If it were reviewed, would it be adequate not to have to go to that? Or we're not objecting to taking this to
Senator Rest Committee.
To Senator Rest Committee.
Yeah, we'll talk.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, I think that if it stays in, Senator Rest is going to want to take a look at it.
Okay, why don't we just do that?
And it might be actually a better place to deal with the question because you'll have the experts that understand the point there.
I think that's a good idea, Mr. Nauman. Thank you.
Senator Erickson Ropes said we're going to go to Senator Rummel's bill in at 5:15.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. This is on page one about the five strands. Now, I'm not a literacy expert or a reading specialist, but, I have gone through a whole series of renditions in education in the past when, OBE was in for a while, then something else was in for a while, then whole language, I think Senator Hann referenced later. How does this five-strand piece fit in terms of, is it like the approach of the moment, because I'm a little concerned if we put teaching strategies into law. Now, is this something that everyone says is wonderful and everyone agrees with?
Perhaps have Susan Thompson
put curriculum into statute. Is that right?
No. Well, we already have this. Since we already have these five strands in statute now, and I think to have Nancy Sears from the Reading Center talk a little bit about background, because this comes from the National Reading Panel report, and where they identified the five most effective after reviewing thousands of pieces of literature.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and I don't need a lot
Senator
of background.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
I just wanted to know, and I think you answered that question. I heard some sort of testimony referencing something earlier. So just, I think you answered my question in that it's not just like the strategy du jour, yeah. You know, because
Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson Ropes, this has come from the National Reading Panel that researched and reviewed a multitude of research and determined that for good reading instruction to occur, all five of these strands need, you can't pick two or three, okay. Reject some. All five of them are important to developing strong literacy and ability to read. Okay. And can you, is this Nancy Sears from the Rochester Reading Center? Maybe you can, a sentence or two to further describe what that means.
One sentence.
Pardon me?
One sentence.
One sentence. There has been over 30 years of research in what a child needs to learn to read, and it's embodied in the National Reading Panel and the five strands.
Okay, great. Mr. Chair, that's really all I needed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Saltzman will entertain a motion.
I would like to move the Senate file 3156.
As amended.
As amended, and it will
state
be going
and local.
To the State and Local Government Operations Committee.
Okay, further discussion, and there's still at least a couple of committees where it would go, and the authors will continue to discuss this with stakeholders as well as follow the progress and the rules. No further discussion. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No? Carried. Thank you very much. Senator Rummel. And I believe we have an amendment to Senate File 2882. Senator Rummel moves the A1 amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. We now have Senate File 2882 as amended. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Being the last one on the agenda, knowing that you are all tired, and then I'm going to be editing my remarks as we go to keep things moving, so pardon me if it gets a little clumsy. I'm pleased to bring to you to the table Senate File 2882. This bill before you is the result of the work we did this summer. We were part of a work group that worked on accountability. And our work was a product of a bill we passed last session. And that bill charged us to work with curriculum and measurement experts so that we might consider how we would fully, fairly, and accurately report student achievement and emphasize school excellence using multiple performance measures that are objective and consistent with the highest standards in the field of education measurements. We had four hearings. I will not go through the hearings that we had with you in the interest of time. First of all, I want to acknowledge the University of Minnesota. We used the university or collaborated with the university as our experts, and they educated us on the various issues that addressed student achievement and accountability. And with me at the table is Dr. David Johnson from the university. Our fourth hearing, I'll just jump to the fourth hearing, was on February 6th. And at that time, we brought the first draft of this bill. Our goal was to make it very public so we could take public input on the bill. And whether or not a lot of people didn't get to that hearing or whether, I don't know what happened, but it's only in the last few days that I've been hearing from people about the bill. I have been working with the Department of Education. We've had two meetings, and my understanding is the person who is carrying this bill in the House is arranging another meeting with the department to address some of the concerns that still remain. We will go through the bill and after we hear from our witnesses, because I think if you hear from the witnesses, you'll have a better sense of what we're trying to do. And then when we go through the bill, we can address the amendment that was just passed. I have with me at the table Michelle Walker, who is Chief Accountability Officer. I wanted to get that right, from the St. Paul Public Schools. And I hope Michelle will share with you an overview of the value of having multiple measures. Dr. David Heistad will present what we thought was a growth model that we thought we had at least some agreement with the department on that met the department's criteria, and he'll walk you through that. That's the heart of the bill. Mr. Kent Bickel will deal with college readiness measurement, and the person who worked with us on the engagement issue is in St. Louis presenting her research. And the engagement part of this bill is out in the future. It will be shaped by input from lots of people, and so we don't need to get too bogged down in the details of that. It's more or less letting people know that there is this sound research and why it's important. So without further ado, is it Dr. Walker?
Ms. Walker.
Ms. Walker.
Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. Good afternoon, Chairman Wieger and members of the Education Committee. My name for the record is Michelle Walker, and I am the Chief Accountability Officer for St. Paul Public Schools. I'm pleased to speak before you on Senate File 2882 regarding revisions to the state report card. I previously expressed support of an earlier version of this bill before the Joint House and Senate Work Group on the State Report Card and the companion piece that was introduced in the House earlier this week. I want to take this time to acknowledge Senator Rummel and Representative Breinert and the members of the Joint House and Senate Work Group on the State Report Card for their leadership and process of engaging district stakeholders and others in the development of this legislative proposal. This bill reflects the high priority that Minnesota places on education, and I'm excited to be a new member of this community. The focus of my remarks today will be to once again underscore the value of multiple measures of academic success and the ways that this proposed legislation can support the efforts within St. Paul, public schools, and the needs of children and parents across the state. The state report card is viewed by many as an authoritative source for summary information on school and district performance, and frankly, what the state publishes about schools matters. Parents and families use this information to make decisions about which districts and which schools they will select for their children. As you have acknowledged, the state report card must present an accurate picture of our schools and districts so that the public can make valuable comparisons. As Minnesota moves forward in developing its next generation of accountability for schools, the report card should also be refined to reflect our current context. It should help parents make informed choices about public education options available to them. In St. Paul, we are known for our history of providing an array of educational choices to parents. Senate File 2882 provides the policy and legislative foundation to support our efforts in these following areas. With respect to accountability and growth, our strategic plan for continued excellence articulates our priorities to the community and sets forth 12 major outcomes by which we will measure our success. It raises expectations for all of our students and establishes challenging targets for these indicators through 2011. Being transparent about our successes and our shortcomings is vital to our commitment to the residents of our city. Just as we did this past November, we will continue to publish our progress report on our implementation of the plan and to continue to hold ourselves accountable to the public. Quite frankly, that report will be the unvarnished truth about our progress as we see them on the indicators we have selected. We use an apples-to-apples comparison as a way to make better use of the MCA and MCA 2 results. Students are compared to their peers statewide who have the same ethnicity, free reduced lunch status, English language learner status, and special education status. And this also serves as a meaningful indicator for schools as they interpret the state results. student growth on MCA2 is also an important indicator because it accounts for last year's achievement. In the fall, we calculated a growth measure at the district level and conducted workshops with our schools so that they would be able to make sense of it and use it. So we are very pleased to see that this kind of analysis will be included in the state report card. So after we combine our apples to apples and our MCA growth, as well as all of the other indicators, we have a more comprehensive picture of our district and each of our schools than we've ever had before. And this array of data enables us to identify and recognize schools that are making comprehensive improvement, as well as what we call beating the odds. So we are very pleased that the recommended changes in this legislation, once approved, will address having a collection of information to show the whole picture. We want to continue to work with the Department of Education to ensure that when this legislation, once approved, is implemented, that we have a system that is workable and a valuable source of information for identifying excellent performance and work that we are doing with particular groups of students. I will speak very briefly to the other two sections of the bill, one regarding advanced coursework, just to express our support for having such an indicator included in the legislation. We believe that we have started efforts to increase college readiness at our school district, and having legislation to support that work will be great. Lastly, with regard to the student surveys, we believe that it is very important to understand the culture of our schools and to create safe and welcoming environments for all of our students. We have already begun a process of preparing survey instruments so that we can collect additional data in our district. We would ask that as the state moves forward to implement this aspect of the legislation, that they work with the school districts to use some of the tools and measures that we've already begun to use in that regard. The one last piece that I would like to say is, in the face of declining enrollment for a district like ours, potential revenue shortfalls, and increasing mandates, we do hope that new reporting requirements will be looked at in terms of their vital importance and that they would not be financially burdensome to implement. We thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and we're very excited about the great efforts that are currently underway. We look forward to the approval of this bill and working with the Department of Education on its implementation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walker.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. And now I would like to turn to Dr. David Heistead, who can explain far better than I'll ever be able to explain the ins and outs of the growth model he is suggesting that we implement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. My name is David Heistead. I'm Executive Director of Research, Evaluation, and Assessment at Minneapolis Public Schools, and I've served in that capacity the last 10 years. In Minneapolis, we have a similar model based on growth norms, and there are over 300 districts in the state now using a similar model with the Northwest Evaluation Association's tests. So this isn't something totally foreign to the districts. I'm going to make this presentation quite brief. I would like to go over just a couple of major points in the handout which you have. The first is that I view this as an effort-based accountability system. This would give us an ability throughout the state to measure the effects of our interventions in a much more sensitive way. The current system that we have primarily relies on the No Child Left Behind mandates for accountability. And those are very important. The spirit of that law and many of the specifics on reporting out achievement gaps, et cetera, have been a tremendous mover for the state. But in addition to keeping all of those measures of high performance, we're proposing to add multiple measures. Similar to St. Paul, we want to look at the growth of students, individual students across time. The state has been working towards this. The Department of Education has done a tremendous job in pulling together the Minnesota assessment experts and getting consensus around a growth score. They've created a score already which can measure progress on individual students from time one to time two to time three, and that will be on the parents' report this year. What you'll see on the parents' report is similar to the last graph I will show, where you can see where you are versus the standards and what kind of rate of progress each individual student is making. So this bill does not, this adds to, it's complementary to No Child Left Behind and doesn't replace any of those mandates. We feel that this will be an equitable system for districts. If the district has a lot of students that are already above the standard, those students won't be neglected. The current No Child Left Behind law, it doesn't give credit to any schools for advancing students beyond proficient to the very highest levels. This growth model would actually provide additional information and feedback to districts, to the leadership teams, and to the parents about students that are already above the standards. And, of course, it will also provide information on students who are not yet at the standards. What is the rate of acceleration for those students? And we believe this will be seen as an equitable system. And then, as mentioned already, this is a way that the state can help districts identify beat-the-odds schools. These would be schools that are producing exceptional growth. We can look across the various categories of No Child Left Behind, find districts in outstate Minnesota that are doing a tremendous job for English language learners, or we can look at in St. Paul and find schools that are doing a tremendous job with special education students. We'll be able to find some of the best examples of achievement growth and then explore what are the strategies these schools and districts are using to create this tremendous growth. The method for pinpointing intensive assistance currently relies only on the No Child Left Behind categories. And sometimes we're identifying schools as underperforming that are actually making very good progress with their students. Because the current system only looks at the level of performance, the percentage of students who are proficient, it may miss the fact that some schools that are not yet at those standards are producing tremendous growth in reading and math. And one way of looking at this, I believe I shared this with a subcommittee of this body, is to look at growth and achievement at the same time. On this chart on the overhead, you can see in the bottom left-hand corner, you have schools that are not only low on the standards, on the achievement level, but they are very low on achievement growth. These are the schools that everybody knows need intensive, immediate assistance. And they are the schools that may need to be fresh started or have a very new and powerful curriculum put in them. But in the bottom right-hand corner, you have schools that they may not yet be hitting all the standards, and they may have many struggling students in their school, but they're showing such tremendous gain that we would call these schools beat-the-odds schools. They have high trajectories of growth for all groups of students. Now, up in the upper left-hand corner, you have some schools that nobody talks about. Those would be schools that are hitting their AYP targets, but they may not be making very good growth. So just because all the students come into their school above average doesn't mean that they can't accelerate their growth as well. So this is the kind of framework that a district could use to identify which schools need intensive assistance, which schools we really need to recognize even though they're not yet there. And, of course, the high achievement, high growth schools are schools that are, need to be given the freedom to continue their great work and hit the high standards with all students accelerating. As I mentioned, the Department of Education has created a scale score already. It's called the Vertically Linked Scale Score. That just means you can measure progress from third grade to fourth grade to fifth grade to sixth grade, similar that, as to a growth or a height chart in a doctor's office. It's a continual measure of progress. So you can compare measure of individual students versus those standards, and if the student is already above the standards, you can see how far they're accelerating that progress. That vertically linked scale score then can be used to create state growth norms. And we've already worked with some of the real data, and we've looked at what typical growth is in the state. In fact, I met with Assistant Commissioner Christy Hovanec-Lasala, and we determined that the typical state growth is not sufficient. Students that start below the standards are not going to catch up to the standards if they only make typical growth. So what we have changed from the original legislation is to look at students that are making greater than normal growth. And so we would report out the percentage of students that are making the standard, but we would also report out the percent that are making more than a year's growth, and those would be the highlighted group. I can show you a graph of what that might look like. Here in Minnesota, by definition, 33% of the students would be making above state norm growth, and 33% would be at making state norm growth, and of course, 33% would be below state norm growth. Now, you might find a district similar to Minneapolis where there are lots of students making at a year's growth, but only 20% are making accelerated growth. So we would much rather see that district performing like this school. This school has 30% making a year's growth at the state norm growth, and 45% making accelerated growth. Now, this would be a school that you would want to visit, find out what kind of strategies they're using, and try to learn from the faculty and the administration, the leadership in the school. So that's an example for the total school. In addition, if my we'll move it this way, you would be able to look at subgroups. And this is the way you would look at it, that narrowing the achievement gap. Here's a school where 55% of the students in free reduced price lunch were making greater than a year's growth. So this would be a way of identifying schools by subgroup. We would also have gender, that we would look at gender as well as the No Child Left Behind categories. I will skip the detailed explanation of the trichotomous model versus the dichotomous model, but just know
Who wants to hear about the trichotomous?
The trichotomous model, the department and our work team are advocating now really looks at accelerating achievement progress for all. I think the two issues that may be remaining, and I don't know if the department is going to be talking about, would be the specific definitions of value added and whether the value added would be brought down to the individual teacher level. And the subgroup recommended bringing down the value added to the level of the team, the teams of teachers working together, rather than the individual teacher level, for three reasons. One is that you have low reliability when you have a few number of students that are in individual classroom teachers, especially if you have high mobility in the school. The second is that it would require a massive data collection procedure, which involves teachers having to identify what percentage of the time each teacher is spending with each student on reading and math. So if there were four different reading teachers, each teacher would have to claim 33%, 17%, et cetera. It can be done, and if it's the will of the legislature, this model can do it. It's just that the team didn't recommend it. And the third factor would be it sort of emphasizes competition among teachers to report out individual teacher coefficients, whereas many of the models now are working at collaboration among teachers. So for that reason, the team did not recommend it, but this model would be appropriate, I mean, could be appropriately brought down at that level if the resources were put in.
What is the team you're talking about?
And the team that I'm talking about would be the grade level team that would include the special education. The team that advised the committee was a members of the Minnesota Assessment Group. We had the head of assessment for Bloomington Public Schools, head of assessment for South Washington Public Schools, head of assessment for St. Paul Public Schools, and for Roseville Public Schools. So the five members reached consensus on this model, and we propose that to you now.
Thank you, Dr. Eisted.
Thank you. I realize, Mr. Chair, that you have to move on. Mr. Paquel and Dr. Johnson will give some brief remarks, and then we will allow time for the department to speak.
Thank you.
And I apologize that we don't have time to go through the bill in detail.
Well, a great deal of foundation's been laid over the interim as well as subcommittee updates. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. The economy is much on all of our minds today, and it's very clear that there is almost nothing that is as important to individual Minnesotans, to communities, or to the state as college readiness, because the benefits come from college completion. We know the best predictor of college readiness is the rigor of the courses a student takes in high school. If a student takes a truly college-ready curriculum, he or she has a 95% chance of earning an undergraduate degree. And students of color and low-income students and other students that are drastically underrepresented in higher education also benefit from that rigorous course taking. In Minnesota, we have a lot of work to do on that counts. According to the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education, only 46% of our high school students take advanced math, while in the top states, 64% do. 29% take advanced science, while in the top percent, the top states, 40% do. Only 32 to 35% of our students take a foreign language. If we're going to ramp up college readiness, we need to ramp up rigorous course taking, and so I want to strongly support that provision of the bill. I do want to briefly express a note of caution about the language that is in there about comparing student schools that have similar student populations to each other in this regard. Regardless of how many students who are on free and reduced price lunch or face other challenge factors in the school, we believe that access to rigorous coursework should be equal across all of our schools in the state. That detail aside, the provision of the bill to include rigorous course taking on a report card, we think, would move this forward for our kids and families.
Thank you, Mr. McCall.
Chair Weiger and members of the committee, thank you. I'm going to speak very briefly to Section 9, which talks about another set of measures which addresses everything from school student safety to their well-being. I'm not going to speak to the issue of safety or to the issue of relationships with teachers as expressed in the Act here. I'll talk more or less specifically to the, and very briefly, to the issue of student engagement. We know, the real essence of this is, we know that students, from research, the students who are engaged in schools or curriculum and all the offerings of what has offered in public school settings in this state, that they perform better in terms of their academic work. They are less likely to engage in risk behaviors, such as disciplinary problems, low attendance situations, and from my own research, and this is why I can speak to it, from the area of school completion. So engaged, we've looked mostly at this in relation to students who are engaged relative to their ability to stay in school, remain in school, and perform well and access post-secondary education later. So fundamentally, what we are proposing here is a process by which to begin to take a look at that. We have at the University of Minnesota been investigating student engagement for many years. The specific reference that Senator Rummel made here to the university and the faculty member is Dr. Sandra Christensen, and her colleagues, I'm included, have looked at what's called the student engagement inventory. That is, in and of itself, I think enough explanation of that. But anyway, I guess, given the importance of this and what we know from research for over three decades on the importance of engaging young people in their school settings through relationship patterns, through alterable variables at the school level that can help to promote this, we need to measure it, and we need to include it in Minnesota report card, and that's kind of where we stand on it.
Thank you. We'll now ask Commissioner Segrin.
Just by way of summary, Mr. Chair, excuse me. We set out to do a job because we recognize in our culture that we can either value what we measure or measure what we value. And we believe that the people who came forward during our sessions to tell us what was important, what were the expectations we had for our students, we ought to recognize or measure those things that are highly important. The first was that there is advancement in student learning, and the growth factor or model or whatever we call it does that. The second thing that we hear it everywhere. We value or we're telling our schools it is very important to get students ready to go into college. And so the second measure is there. And then the third value that we hear most from parents is, are my children safe? Do they like school? Are they engaged? And so that is our third measure. The second and the third measure are out in time. They're not effective in the near future. We put together a group of people, and those things will be refined further as we move along.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. Commissioner. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to be with you this evening. I just have brief remarks. I think that most of you have received the letter that I had sent to Representative Reinert and Senator Rummel. They had asked us to respond in writing to some of the concerns that we had, and we wanted to outline that. But I do want to make it clear that we appreciate the opportunity. We've met a couple of times with both Representative Reinert and Senator Rummel on their proposal to get our reaction, particularly on the growth model calculations that they've done. And as Mr. Heistad said, after we looked at the first initial calculations, we were very concerned that the growth expectations were not rigorous enough. And we continue to have concerns that whatever growth model that we set, we really see aggressive growth in students, particularly those who coming in at third grade are not proficient, and we want to get them proficient quickly so that by high school they can start thinking about being college ready and taking the kind of rigorous courses they need. If they're not proficient by eighth grade, they're going to have a very hard time taking Algebra 1 in eighth grade, et cetera. So that is one of our very big concerns. In addition to that, the legislation also proposed striking much of the language that referred to our value-added language that was put in a number of years ago. And this was done on a very bipartisan basis. We wanted to eventually, as we developed a growth model, which we all wanted to do, we also then wanted to, growth model, of course, is the basis for them looking at the value that is added by schools, by districts, by teachers, and looking at all of that and analyzing it so that we can decide how we can improve instruction in schools. So we're very concerned that that language has been eliminated. Senator Rummel and Representative Reinert have indicated that they are willing to work with us on reinstating that language and bringing it more technically up to date, if you will. But we do feel very strongly that if that is not reinstated, that this language would not be accepted by the Department of Education. We have some other concerns. Some of them are more questions. There's certainly the definitions that are in the beginning of the bill. We would like redefined. Value added has a definite definition. And so does growth, and we would like to clarify those, and there's been indications that those definitions would be considered. Also, we have some concerns about some of the mandates in the bill to create a data collection system that would collect the course taking of students. That's going to take quite a lot of money to do that. We are not against that at all. That is something that we would really love to do, because we think that that would be an added value to whatever we're looking at as far as research goes and how we can improve instruction. But again, that's a fiscal concern for us. There's also direction that our department will not only look at school improvement for students or for districts that are not making AYP, but for any school district that is not making the growth goals, for our state system too. And again, we are trying to keep up with just our AYP schools, and to add this addition, we would really need additional resources. So we are concerned about that. Again, we have, you know, just some other things. I don't want to go into all of the details of it. They're articulated in the letter, but I think the main things that we want to emphasize to you is the unfunded mandates, making sure that we do have a robust value-added definition and expectations to use value-added, and then starting with this growth indicator to build towards a really robust value-added system in the future that would include schools, school districts, and teachers.
Thank you. I'll ask Senator Romo first if she has a response, and we'll open it up for some comments. And Senator Romo.
When we started on this project, I often, you know, right in the beginning, I wondered if we would ever even get this far. So we took on a very large job and worked on it all summer long. And the time lag between when we had our first draft of the bill and our ability to refine it has taken some time. Both Representative Reinert and myself are committed to continue working with the department on their concerns. We do believe we've answered some of them that are in the letter. I understand that after Representative Reinert passed her bill out of committee yesterday, that at least a plan for a meeting is in the works. So, yes, we are committed to working with the department and moving forward. We have asked and have received, there will be a fiscal note on this, and in Finance Committee, we will be dealing with that. We do not plan to let you go unfunded.
Thank you.
Senator Henn, Erickson Ropes, and Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Rommel, I'm not quite sure if I understand this state growth norm, and maybe someone can give a little bit of explanation. In your definitions, it's an established statewide average. I'm trying to understand, are we saying that that what we're going to be measuring from is an average score across the state for whatever it is, I suppose, by subject area, and use that and measure growth as compared to an average? And is that really a sufficiently high standard to be measured against?
Dr. Heisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn. The fundamental element of growth is how much achievement gain takes place from last year to this year. And the question is, how much growth do we have to see to be excited about it? And we initially started out with a proposal where we figured out what the state average growth was for every grade level at every point along the distribution. So you have a different growth norm for every student. If they start high and they're close to the ceiling of the test, the expected growth would be less. If they start low and need to make acceleration, the expected growth is higher. But when we looked at that growth, by projecting from the norms, would the child catch up? Would they go from partially proficient to proficient in 5 years? The answer was no. And so to answer your question, the average growth was not sufficient to get students up. That's why we proposed the trichotomous model, which I didn't go into in detail, but it breaks the norms into three pieces. Therefore, you have 33% that are below, at, and above. And it's the above group that we're going to have to accelerate. If Minneapolis schools and every district in the state that has students in poverty doesn't make more than a year's growth with those students, they're not going to catch up to the standard. So the expectation we've made more rigorous with the help of the commissioner and the department to make sure that students, we're tracking students making more than 1 year's growth as well as making a year's growth.
And Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
And thank you. Thank you, Doctor. I guess a couple of questions, setting aside the missing 1% there, 33, 33, 33. There's 1%.
Well, 33.3, 33.33.
Okay. Yeah. So you got that infinite number.
Thank
out
you.
There. But I think one of the virtues of a report card structure is its ease of accessibility by the public. And I'm struggling with this a little bit here to say, if we publish this kind of data, is it going to make any sense to people? And you can respond to that. But I also have a question in this definition on page 1 of the bill on the norm. And it talks about, I guess in the amendment that was deleting some of the original language, talks about a recognized Minnesota assessment group. Recognized by whom, I guess, would be one question. Is that group an existing group, or is it one that would come into being? And I'm, frankly, I'm a little concerned about that we are delegating power to this group to establish these norms that then the commissioner must, by law, implement. And I'm a little concerned about that. It seems like we're delegating a pretty significant responsibility to a group that isn't maybe clearly defined or known that the commissioner is going to have to respond to and implement their instructions.
My understanding is that we would be giving all of the information on how the norms were developed to the department to implement. So I have a computer program that I use to analyze the data, and I would pass that to the department's folks so they can replicate what was done and then verify that what was done was accurate. So I don't think the advisory team, I think, has a different function that maybe Senator Rummel can
Mr. talk Chair.
To.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, we have concerns about that also because the language clearly says that this advisory group would create the norms and be given to the commissioner and the commissioner shall implement them. Advisory groups generally don't have that kind of authority. Now, we would certainly be willing to, and the group, frankly, that's recommended is the MAG group that's been in existence, and it's a great group of folks that we work with all the time that are assessment directors. Because it's not a formal group, we suggested that there be just some language in there saying that the commissioner shall work with assessment, et cetera, people recognized, et cetera. What we would say is to recommend to the commissioner the norms, but the way the language still says is that they shall, do this and tell the commissioner to implement it. And that's highly unusual. I don't think I've ever seen legislation that an advisory group had that kind of authority. So we would have concern, and I have concerns legally about it because we have to be legally able to defend some of these things too, and the buck will stop with me. So,
Mr. Chair, I believe that the amendment that was adopted yesterday struck the Minnesota Assessment Group and the other informal group, so that they don't have that responsibility anymore.
And Mr. Chairman,
members, we have run out of time. We have several additional questions. I want to thank Senator Rummel and others for the many months of activity in developing this proposal. And as the various testifiers have indicated, there's areas that are still being discussed. And I believe, Senator Rummel, you mentioned there's different meetings to look at additional language. And in recognizing that there's additional policy committee questions, the purpose today, we got it on the table. Various issues have been raised, and we will continue the discussion on this at a future meeting, and we'll consult as to which date we want to hear it on. Is that okay, Senator Rummel?
Is it possible that we could move it on and discuss it in finance?
For those members that are not on policy, that are not on finance, that are in policy, that have not had a chance to ask a question, they've asked for that opportunity, and I need to respect that. So
I'm concerned that I brought my witnesses here. They were here for 3 hours, and to bring them back again is a bit of a burden.
Mr. Chair, okay. I'll pass on my question.
Pardon me?
I'll pass on my question.
Okay. Senator Torres Ray?
Senator Weir, I would like to take a vote because I believe that we're fully aware of the work that Senator Rummel has done. We've attended numerous meetings. We've been talking to many people. We are aware of the work that you've done, and it's remarkable. You've also brought experts in the field who are very supportive and appreciative of the work that you've done. And so I am prepared to take a vote and support you on that effort. We did not hear just from any people in the community.
Okay, Senator Torres, you made your point. Is there? I mean, I'm on the Finance Committee, and we'll have a chance. But is there anyone else, Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, this is the Ed Policy Committee. This is the state report card. And frankly, I feel like that we have heard information, but I do not feel like there has been any discussion on this bill. And I want Senator Rummel and her bill to proceed, absolutely. But I don't think that just because of the hour on the clock that we shirk our responsibility. And that's kind of what I feel like the position that I'm being asked to be put in.
Okay.
I understand that. I would hope then that we would be first on the agenda next time.
Yes. We'll work out the placement on the agenda, and it'll be at the next meeting.
Mr. Chairman, is it appropriate then to just lay the bill on the table for...
Yes, we'll lay it on the table.
I make that motion.
On that motion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Same sign. The committee is adjourned.